This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, hello, hello. What do you know? Another week gone, and welcome to another episode of Moments That Rock. I'm your host, Tony Michael. This, we are part of the Pantheon Group of Podcasts, the largest music podcast site in the world. Today, we have a little change of direction. We have a gentleman who is actually a crime novelist and a knight, would you believe? His name is Cyrean Rankin, but we shall allow him to do the rest himself.
Hi there. I'm Ian Rankin, or Sir Ian Rankin, I guess, these days.
Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, musical. The thing about a show like this is I could speak for 24 hours uninterrupted on moments in music that have meant something to me. And trying to whittle it down, I think, is tough. But
well, tough start for you. You'll have to come back then.
Yeah, I'm happy to come back.
Excellent. Let's roll with it.
I was thinking back this morning, you know, I mean, the first musical device that entered our house would have been my sister's Dansette record player. She was about 7 years older than me. One Christmas or birthday, she got a Dansette record player. And I think I was more thrilled than she was. Before that, we'd been reliant on a transistor radio and Radio One, which mostly meant Tony Blackburn when you were getting ready for school in the morning. The Dansette changed my life. Although I couldn't afford to buy many records when I was a small kid, I mean, I'm talking about when I was 10, 11, I would save up my pocket money, and every few weeks I could go down to the record shop in the nearby town. The town I grew up in was a village and had no record shop. So I'd go down to Kirkcaldy in Fife, which is the nearest decent-sized town, and go to one of the mainstream record stores, Woolies, Woolworths, or Boots, or whatever, John Mingus, John Menzies, the stationers, and buy a single. And it was round about the time of bubblegum pop, of Slade and T-Rex and stuff like that.
So before Bruce's records, eh?
Well, Bruce's records was there. I remember sending my mum in, I think for my 13th birthday, I sent my mum into Bruce's to buy a Jimi Hendrix LP for me. And she said when she came out, she felt like going and having a bath afterwards because she'd been amongst all these hairy hippies. And Bruce's change, it was quite interesting because it was full of hairy hippies and joss sticks and gong albums. And then it suddenly became the centre of punk. Bruce Finlay got very interested in punk quite early on, and he went on to manage Simple Minds to stadium-filling success. Now, I mean, Bruce lives here in Edinburgh. I see him quite a lot. And Bruce's did become important later on. It wasn't important in the early days, but when I got into punk, Bruce's was my premier destination. And I did get into punk. I mean, I was the right age for punk. I was 17 in 1977. You know, almost my last year at high school. We had a local band called the Skids. The guitarist in the Skids, Stuart Adamson, who went on to glory with Big Country, was 2 years above me at Cowdenbeath High School. I mean, as far as live gigs go, although I'd been to see a few of the prog rockers in my earlier days, the Barclay James Harvest of this world, it was the Skids, who I would go and see every possible occasion in Fife, who really turned me on to live music. Those are my best early experiences. And of course, because, punk told you you didn't have to have any talent. You just wanted to go out and get it. So I then joined a punk band called the Dancing Pigs, which was five second best punk band. There were only two punk bands. It was the Skids and us. And we would save up our money and go into a studio and lay down some tracks. Now, I do remember getting, I think we had about five tracks that we'd recorded on a cheap cassette tape and sending it off to John Peel in the expectation we would be the next big thing. He never played it. My hope is that somewhere in the John Peel archive, there still is a demo tape of the Dancing Pigs, because I sure as heck haven't got one.
We'll see if we can find it for you.
That would be nice.
So in your early days, before you started writing, had you ever thought of using your writing skills to write songs, or was it always crime novels?
No, it was, I mean, I started off trying to do cartoons, strip cartoons. I was a fiend for comics, Dandy and the Beano and Batman and Spider-Man and stuff. But I was terrible at drawing. I couldn't draw. All my figures were little stick people. But I would make I would get bits of paper and fold them in half to make little booklets, and I would fill them up with cartoons. That was the start of the writing bug. And then I would sit in my bedroom writing song lyrics and poems, I guess. For bands that didn't exist. My first band never existed except on paper. They were called the Amoebas. And I don't have any of their lyrics. I used to have these books, jotters full of my writings about the adventures of the Amoebas. The lead singer was called Ian Caput. That was me. I took them on tours and I wrote their lyrics and they appeared on chat shows and I scripted all of that. And I created this world on paper, because I couldn't do it in real life. I had no musical ability, and nobody I knew had any musical ability or could afford instruments. So from the age of 11 or 12, my interest in music was on paper, was me having adventures by listening to stuff eventually on the cassette player that I got for Christmas one year. And in fact, some of the tapes I still have, the first tapes I got, one of them was Hawkwind, In Search of Space, and I've still got that and I still play it. And Dark Side of the Moon was a very early tape that I got, and that really turned my head around. Sitting in this little 6x6 bedroom in a council house in a coal mining village in Fife, far away from the glamour and the bright lights, this stuff was catnip to me. But I had to imagine a lot of it. I had to imagine what it was like to be in a band, what it was like to be surrounded by the lights and the glamour. And I just used my imagination to do all of that. And then, of course, when I joined the Dancing Pigs at the grand old age of 17, 18, I discovered there was no glamour. And women didn't throw themselves at you. It was a hugely disappointing experience for all.
Plenty of dancing pigs, though, places to go.
Well, our first ever gig, let me tell you this, our first ever gig was in the YWCA in Cowdenbeath. And we were playing it with some special needs kids who were on a day trip to Fife. And as part of their fun and entertainment, there was an evening gig and we were it. And we were on this rickety stage. The keyboard player's keyboards kept nearly falling off. He told me I couldn't bounce up and down, otherwise his keyboards were going to go flying. We had a bubble machine that we'd bought or rented. We had a strobe. We were told to switch the strobe off because the special needs kids were having seizures. So all the house lights came up and we played to a fully lit hall of special needs kids. And I remember at the end, I mean, we thought it had gone awfully well, obviously. And at the end, one of the kids came up with a little scrap of paper and said, "Are you the Ramones?" And we said, "Yes, we are the Ramones." And I signed Joey Ramone on this kid's scrap of paper. And that was one of the few gigs we ever played.
Funny to hear you say about kind of, coming up with the names and stuff and not being a great musician. It reminds me of myself, because I decided, when I was in my early teens, I wanted to be a footballer, I wanted to play for Manchester United. Then I grew out of that and into wanting to be a rock star. So I became a bass player. And the reason I got the gig was I was the best at coming up with the names of the bands. I came up with like Dwarf Cornell and things like that and stuff. But I was a lousy bass player, but I had the biggest room to rehearse in. So I got the gig. And when I realised I was so crap, I decided to manage a band that didn't have any gigs and weren't going to get a record contract. So it was an easy entry route into the music industry for me. But you're obviously very passionate about music and stuff, Ian, which is great. I read something on, maybe watched something on YouTube about you had a little retreat to go to write your books. Did you, have you ever sat in a place like that and thought about writing songs and stuff? I mean, you can still do both, couldn't you?
Don't give up your day job, like.
Well, I mean, a few years ago, I was tempted back. I dipped a toe back in the water. I was asked to be the vocalist in a band of middle-aged men, most of them journalists.
Come on, give us a name.
Yeah, Best Picture. Best Picture.
Oh, right.
I think that's the idea. And we even have a song called Best Picture. And we would rehearse and have fun, and we would sit and we would come up with ideas, and I would write the lyrics and stuff. And we had a couple of cover versions that we did. And we played a few gigs, supporting bands and headlining and stuff. But then COVID came along. And, well, first of all, our keyboard player was stolen by another band. Then our bass player moved to London. One of our guitarists lives in Glasgow. The other three of us were in Edinburgh. So rehearsals weren't easy. And then COVID came along. And I think at that point, we just gave up. But we did go into a studio and put down a couple of tracks and release a 7-inch single. So on pink vinyl, so on screaming pink vinyl, Best Picture, Isabel is the name of the song. So I thought, yeah, that'll do me. The Dancing Pigs never did manage to get a record made. But because we had money in our pockets and could afford to do it, Best Picture did get a single made. And I've got lots of copies of it sitting in my office here.
Excellent. It's just really, seriously, though, it's a release of creative energy, isn't it? If you want to kind of do that and you can find the time to do it and then just go and concentrate on what basically plays the role.
Yeah, it's a very different thing because being a novelist, of course, I get to play God. I have the power of life and death. Nobody sees anything I've done until I'm happy with it. In a band, you're one member of a group. It's got to be collegiate. You've got to agree on things. Everybody's got to be pitching and everybody's got to be doing stuff. And I'm not much of a team player, really. I've got very used to just doing everything for myself, by myself. So being in a band was a very different way of looking at the creative process. And I did find it really interesting. And sometimes, you know, the other band members came up with a good line for a song or even a good idea for a song, a good idea for a lyric. And I was fine with that. I didn't mind that at all. But it was good to be in a group of creative people rather than just sitting here on my own, terrified that what I'm doing is no good. It was nice to be around people, all of whom knew what we were doing was no good.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to hear what you're saying, Ian, because, you know, you've probably been really good at, like, being a leader. You don't have to be kind of, you know, thinking you're superior to the others. But I have lots of stories from my early days with working with artists and seeing what they've had. A great story with a guy who managed a very successful band who wanted to manage this up-and-coming band. And he sat down and called a meeting and said, and the first thing he said was he slapped his hand on the table and says, listen, let's start with, what are we going to do when this all goes wrong? Because trust me, it will. Yeah. Which is a kind of reality check, you know, because there's a lot of people doing, you know, things that kind of slow you down on the creative side. So you have like different areas to release your creative energy and thing. I think you probably would have brought, and don't worry, I'm not going to send you back into kind of the music world and things. So did you have kind of, you know, you're here. I mean, we all had heroes growing up, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I had musical heroes. The nice thing about, I mean, to flash forward somewhat, the nice thing about becoming a successful writer who uses music a lot in his books is that I did then get access to all these heroes. I got to meet people like Van Morrison. I got to work with Van Morrison.
Oh, my God. Really?
I would interview him live on stage about his book of lyrics, and then he would do a whole band gig afterwards.
Oh, my God.
I traveled around the UK doing that with him for a short time. And it was a lot of fun. I've met every extant member of the Rolling Stones. I mean, Charlie Watts, I met, God bless him, Bill Wyman, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, I've met all of them. Mick Taylor, I've met. Pete Townsend sent me a congratulatory email once about my books.
Brilliant.
All this is leading up to it is one guy whose music I loved was a guy called Jackie Leaven. And I did not know, Jackie Leaven, Scottish singer-songwriter, no longer with us, sadly. I didn't know he was a fan of the books. So in one of my Rebus novels, I've got Inspector Rebus at home listening to Jackie Leaven. Jackie's a fan. He's reading that book on an airplane somewhere above Scandinavia. And he goes, wow, I get a mention. So he got in touch with my publisher. They put us in touch with each other. He said, look, Ian, I'm doing an event at Celtic Connections. Do you fancy coming on stage and doing a reading? And I ended up writing a short story called Jackie Leaven Said. Play on Jackie Wilson Said, which took on board some of the themes that I found in his music. And he then wrote some new songs to accompany that story. And we did it as a gig at Celtic Connections in Glasgow. And it went down so well, we were asked to do it again at the Edinburgh Festival, which we did at the Queen's Hall here in Edinburgh. And it was recorded for posterity. And so suddenly, I've got a double CD that is out in the world, Jackie Leaving and Ian Rankin. And because of that, we have to go touring. He said, what do you want on your rider? I said, what the hell is a rider? He said, it's your onstage, your backstage requirements. I said, I'm a writer. We're lucky if we get a glass of water. I said, you're the musician, Jackie, you do it. So I turned up at the Royal Festival Hall in London for the first gig. I was sharing this huge dressing room with Jackie. He's in a corner tuning his guitar. He's surrounded by stuff. There's a minibar, there's a fridge, there's sandwiches, there's towels, there's this, that, and the other. Huge amounts of stuff. My end of the room, nothing. And then this roadie walks in, backstage guy walks in, he says, who ordered the haggis? And Jackie pointed at me. All he'd written on my rider was Ian Rankin requires one uncooked haggis at every location.
Excellent, haggis. Love it. You're listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michael. And my special guest today is Mr. Stroke Sir Ian Rankin. Ian is a very successful crime novelist, but he's a huge music fan, and I think that comes out in the entire...
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Interview with us. But meanwhile, we'll be back after this.
I have to go back to the Van Morrison thing because I have a story in my book about meeting Led Zeppelin when I was 15 and getting to know what it was like to meet your heroes, because obviously like I grew up with bands like that and things. But Astral Weeks is my favourite album of all time, right? But I remember seeing him a good few years ago back in Manchester where I was living. And he comes on stage and says nothing. And he just kind of plays and stuff. And then you get this at concerts. Somebody from like the third row shouts out, "Broken out girl!" So Van Morrison had said nothing. So he walked up to the microphone, looked down at him and said, "Why don't you just fuck off?" If I sang like that, I'd never get out of the bath, for God's sake. You know, he's an absolute genius. But I don't... You say like... You sound like... You're a friend. Does he have friends?
Well, I mean, he knew I was a... He had found out, someone had told him, I don't know, that I was a fan of his music. I've mentioned it several times in interviews and in the Rebus novels. His people got in touch and said, "Look, Van's doing a book of his lyrics. Do you want to write the introduction?" Ugh. And I said, "Sure." And then at some point, Van decided he wanted to take that on the road. And so I was given the job of interviewing him on stage for 15 minutes before he then did a full band gig.
We can't find that anywhere, can we?
Nah, I don't think so, man.
Oh, bummer.
You have to be in the moment. Sometimes he was fine and he was chatty on stage and that, and then sometimes he just clammed up. Really hard for me as an interviewer when I wasn't getting any answers to the questions. But people were, you know, fans were in tears afterwards. The first one we did was in London. I forget what the theatre was. And people were in tears afterwards. They said, "We've never heard them talk for that long before." You know, we've been to see him 100 times, and he, as you say, he hardly says anything on stage.
Well, that's why I couldn't leave the question alone, you know. That's why I had to come back to that and said, you said what?
Yeah, and we went, you know, we went out for dinner a few times, and I met his daughter, and you know, we hung out a bit, and it was great fun. And he invited me along to his 70th birthday gig on Cypress Avenue. Now that video does exist. It was shown on the BBC fairly recently, and you can see me in the front row, this big cheesy grin on my face, watching him in Cypress. And you know the one, of course, you know the one song he refused to play when he played his 70th birthday on Cypress Avenue in Belfast.
With Cypress Avenue.
Cypress Avenue.
I can imagine. It's like the most obvious thing, you know. But, some of the greats that we love the music by, you know. I mean, even people like Dylan, you know, going back all those years, if somebody said to him, like, what does such, when we all want to know what the lyrics mean, his answer would be, what does it mean to you? Which is kind of a cool answer at the same time, but it's also, like, evasive. And, you know, when you write those songs, they mean something to you. But I think it's nice for an artist to let the interpretation be from the listener and stuff. I'm sure you write stories and other people have other ideas about your stories than you do, maybe.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you know, if you pick up a story or a book and you read it, it is yours. I mean, the story is whatever you think it is. The theme is whatever you think it is. I'm fine with that. Same with lyrics. I mean, when I listen to lyrics, I might get a completely different interpretation of what that song is about. I was once asked by Tim Burgess of the Charlatans to do a little very short story to segue between two tracks in an album. And I listened to the two tracks, and what I took from the lyrics was almost a kind of science fiction story about a private detective. So I did a little linkage that had this monologue from this private detective. He recorded me saying it, it got on the album, and then he videotaped me. And for a while, I would tour with the Charlatans on screen. I'd be on this huge screen behind them, reading this little bit out as they were getting ready to segue between the two tracks. So, I mean, you know, the love of music has brought me to a position where I get to enter that. I mean, I've met Robert Plant, I've met Jimmy Page. I've met a lot of these great musicians, and then sometimes I've got the chance to work with them, which has been a thrill. But I realized early on that I was not a musician. Now, luckily for me, when I got married and moved to London, I got a job on a hi-fi magazine, and the hardware was where it was at. I just loved having a really good hi-fi system. And I love nothing better than dusting off the hi-fi and listening. And whenever I move house, the hi-fi goes with me. I've had the same setup since the late 80s. And the first record on the turntable is always John Martin's Solid Air.
Oh.
Now, one time I was down in London to do Desert Island Discs, this program where you choose 8 records. And one of them is the one that you cannot leave behind if you're on a desert island. And the one that I chose that I couldn't leave behind was Solid Air by John Martin, the track. I was in London to record that program. I was in a restaurant in West London having lunch with my agent. We heard all this raucous, riotous behaviour out on the pavement, went outside after lunch, and it was John Martin sitting with a couple of friends at a table on the pavement with a few bottles of wine. And I wanted to go up to him, never having met him, I wanted to go up and say, the reason I am here is to do Desert Island Discs, and your record is the one record I can't live without. And I bottled it. I just didn't have the courage to go up and actually talk to the guy, because you never knew which John Martin you were going to get.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I worked for Island Records, and I didn't work Solid Air, but I took him to, do you remember Colin Somerville, God rest his soul, at Radio 4th, and Billy Sloan at Radio Clyde and stuff? My job was to haul people around. Yeah, he did have a drinking habit, to say the least. But I remember taking him to Scotland. It was so weird. We were in a car and we were driving. And as soon as we crossed the border, his accent became broader and stuff. And I was sat outside Radio 4th, and he just didn't want to go in. You know, I'd driven like 2 hours to go do an interview. I've got a schedule to meet. And he just like, and it was like, what the hell, you know? And, you know, there was times where kind of it was very kind of awkward because you didn't want to say the wrong thing and stuff, but absolute genius, you know. I mean,
yeah, but of course, now I wish I'd met him, because that was the only chance I was ever going to get. And you should always try and meet your heroes.
There is the hopeless romantic in you that music does take you back to a time and a place. Do you have you seem very prolific. Do you have such a thing as writer's block, where maybe you put on an album and chill out a bit?
No, I've always got music playing when I write, but it has to be instrumental music. Can't have lyrics, or else I'm too busy listening to the lyrics and I'm not writing. It just builds up an atmosphere. So I listen to a lot of Eno, a lot of Ambient, Boards of Canada, Tangerine Dream, maybe some laid-back jazz. And that just plays non-stop while I'm writing. At the end of each writing day, I mean, this room I'm in is where I sit and write the books. But then I go to the room next door, which has got the hi-fi system and all the records in it. And I will sit down and put a record on and just chill out, as you say, just maybe have a beer or a glass of wine and just relax. And it's music. I mean, I don't watch much TV. It's always music is what I want to be doing if I've got any spare time at all. I love it to bits. I do love it to bits. And, like most of the crime writers I know, most of the novelists I know, I would much rather have been a rock star than a writer.
From what I'm hearing is you're kind of like your own A&R person because you kind of create the vibe for where you bring out the best in your writing skills by doing what works for you, you know. I mean, do you actually listen to it on vinyl? You don't have to get up and turn it up without a remote, do you?
I've got vinyl. I did eventually give in to streaming when lockdown came because I knew I could go to record shops and buy records. So I bought a streamer during COVID lockdown. I quite like the streamer. The streamer's okay, but I much prefer vinyl. The last record I bought would have been about 3 or 4 days ago. The new Jesus and Mary Chain and a new Elbow. I listen to CDs as well. I just got, there's a Les Cousins, you know, the folk club in London that John Martin would have played with others in the 60s, Kurt Jansch would have played. They brought a 3-CD set out of music from Les Cousins in Soho. And it's only on CD as far as I know, so I had to buy the CDs, couldn't get the vinyl. But what can I tell you? I'm an analog guy in a digital world. I prefer the old, I mean, you know, I've my turntable, I bought when I was in my 20s, the amps and the speakers through in my office here, I bought when I was in my 20s. Now I'm in my 60s. And that stuff sounds as good to me now as it sounded 40 years ago. In my diary, I used to keep a page a day diary when I was a kid, and I would make lists of the records I would buy if I had the money.
Yeah.
And the only way I knew about the records was either from listening to the radio or else buying the music press. Things like NME and Sounds and Melody Maker were so important because they were a gateway to all this music. I remember reading Alice Cooper thinking, that's a really rough-looking woman. I had no idea.
Very rough.
You know, I read about Alice Cooper in the music press before I ever heard Alice Cooper. And now you go, oh, Billion Dollar Babies is 50 years old this year. That was one of the first cassettes I got when I got my cassette player when I was 13. One of the first tapes I got was Billion Dollar Babies. And 50 years on, I'm still listening. There is something, Tony, about, you know, music is always waiting for you.
Yeah.
You know, stuff you couldn't get hold of or you didn't have access to or you didn't like when you were young, it's waiting for you to come back. It's waiting for you to be ready for it. Same with books. You know, people sometimes go, well, I tried that writer, I didn't much like it. I go, you know, maybe in 10, 20 years' time, you'll come back to it and you'll find that actually it clicks. You get it. You know, stuff I read when I was young, I come back to now and think that's really toe-curling. How could I possibly have liked that author or that book? It's really badly written. The Godfather is the one that springs to mind, the book, rather than the film. But, you know, I wouldn't have listened to jazz when I was in my teens.
Yeah.
Once I got into punk, that was the end of prog rock for me, but I came back to prog rock 30 years later. I listened to more prog now than I probably do punk. But punk came along at a very important time. It came along when I was in my late teens. And that ethos of, if you want to do something, just give it a go, give it a go, give it a go, was important to me as a working class kid who wanted to be a writer but had no role models. Didn't know anybody in the industry, didn't know how to get into the industry.
In those days, Ian, I mean, you know, being on the other side of the pond, I mean, that we were thrown over all those kind of, you know, foreigners, REO, Speedwagon, Asia, a lot of the kind of, you know, bands who've got like 12 albums and one good song, you know. That's probably been a bit kind of, you know, judgmental on it and everything. But I think the great thing with punk and everything was attitude. There was a lot of crap bands at the time, but we ended up with, like, you know, bands like The Clash and stuff that will last forever type thing. But yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I did a radio show, because I complained that the guy that was living with me at the time, Mark Radcliffe at Radio One, went to Radio One from Piccadilly Radio. And I complained about, you know, the fact that, you know, they've taken him off and put another program on playing, like, the playlist stuff. I said, you know, do you know who comes in? Started rolling off Graham Nash, you know, right through, you know, Freddie and the Dreamers into Oasis, Stone Roses, Simply Red, New Order, Joy Division, blah, blah, blah. I said, I live here and I work here, for fuck's sake. The guy says to me, well, why don't you do it? So I go, right, I will. I walked out, I'm clenching my fist. I said, I've never done a mobile disco, a wedding or a bar mitzvah in my life, and I'm broadcasting on one of the biggest stations outside of London. And Frankie Goes to Hollywood, U2 and New Order, my first three programs. They thought it was hilarious. I was working with all of them. But that's what I'm saying about attitude. I was like a punk DJ. Could you go on a commercial radio station which relies on advertising to keep going with a jerk like me behind the mic? And it lasted 12 and a half years.
Nobody knows you're a jerk if all they can hear is your voice, Tony.
Tell me this, though, Ian. Did your parents, when you were watching Top of the Pops, ask you what was this crap you were watching?
Well, of course. Of course. I was indulged. I was allowed to watch Top of the Pops. And it was, I mean, Top of the Pops, and then eventually getting to stay up late enough to watch the Old Grey Whistle Test.
Oh, yeah.
I remember watching the Old Grey Whistle Test, and I think it was a sensational Alex Harvey band. I must have been about 15 or 16, and my jaw hit the floor.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it. It was Next they were doing. They were these violinists with rubber masks on, and they were.
Was he from Glasgow?
Yeah, the band were all from Glasgow, and it was like pantomime, but with a very dark edge to it. The lyrics were very dark. I mean, I went out and got the album the next day. I think I went down to Bruce's record shop in Kirkcaldy and got the album the next day, and I still got that copy of it as well. So the TV was important. Top of the Pops was important. I mean, a lot of the stuff you got on it, of course, especially when punk came along, you would sit through 20 minutes of dross to try and get one punk song.
Yeah.
You know, you wanted to see the Gang of Four, or you wanted to see Simple Minds or whatever. You would sit through any amount of rubbish waiting for it to come on. And then you would wait until 10 o'clock at night so you could switch on to John Peel on Radio One. That was your day mapped out. And then Saturday afternoon, it was down at the record shop to go through the racks and see what picture sleeve 45s they had and what you could afford to buy. And if you couldn't afford to buy it, what could you borrow from your mates?
Yeah.
It was a social activity. You know, you'd go around each other's bedrooms and they'd have records you didn't have. You would lend them records they didn't have. It was an incredibly social thing. And you felt like a gang. Walking around with a record under your arm.
Completely.
I love them.
That was exactly what I did, because I used to go into Manchester every Saturday with my pocket money, and because I knew the people behind the counter, they'd have records waiting for me to listen to. I'd go into the listening booth and I'd spend 3 or 4 hours. And I'd go on with one album, right? Yeah. And that was my education. They turned me onto a lot of the things that I wouldn't have discovered because they had all these deliveries every day. And then, you know what I did in the evening? I would go around to my friend's house, or he'd come round, right? And I bought Led Zeppelin 1 and I wanted to turn him onto it, but I found it. So you have kind of the bragging rights, you know. It's a beautiful feeling. And then all of a sudden he kind of, you know, thinks, I better turn him onto something and things. But that's, you know, I mean, it was kind of the best way to grow up. I wouldn't change it for the world, you know.
Yeah, no, it was. And looking back on those days, I mean, because I've kept all these diaries from when I was a teenager, I can do a certain amount of looking back and remembering. And, you know, it was a pretty boring village I grew up in. It was pretty ordinary. Everybody was much the same. Everybody was fairly straightforward in their thinking and their ways. But in that musical subculture that was out there just joined you up to so many people who, if you were lucky, were going to be with you the rest of your life. I mean, I've got two school friends from high school who still come around to my flat and we listen to records.
Yeah.
Or we go around to their house and we listen to records and we just do it as often as we can. Bottle of wine gets opened and we just sit there. So we all take records with us. So we're still doing the same thing we did as teenagers. And somebody's going, have you heard this new Zappa pressing? Or have you heard these guys before? And, you know, a lot of it they won't like, but occasionally they go, that is absolutely superb.
Yeah.
And you go, right, that's a score. I've scored the goal there. They like what I like.
I think it's brilliant that you've not lost that, because obviously you're busy in your day job, you know, so it's not like you're going to be, you know, wondering, you know, when you're going to write your next novel. You've probably all got it going on all the time. But take the time out to kind of, you know, get into that different kind of zone altogether and just brings a lot of joy and happiness. And, yeah, I find that a lot of the people I grew up with are the type of people I'd like to still keep in contact with, you know, because it's always the lowest common denominator. I mean,
music brings us together.
Absolutely. Anyway, Ian, before we run out, thank you so much. I've loved this. This has been great. And
it's been a nostalgia trip for me, man. A lot of the younger listeners will be going, oh, it's just two old guys talking about the old days.
Well, you know, sometimes I kind of, you know, wonder that. But then again, I think, you know, I mean, I don't want to be elitist about it, but I came from a different time. And, you know, we're not going to be inducting Justin Bieber into the Hall of Fame. So I feel like on a mission to help keep the legacy alive of some of the greatest artists that ever lived. Thanks a million, Ian. Awesome.
Hey, no problem, Tony. Lovely talking to you.
I'll reach out again. And if you do fancy doing it down the line, I'd love to have you back.
Nice one. All right. Yeah, the story's still to be told, buddy.
Oh, yes, I am sure they are. Brilliant. Absolutely love talking to Ian Rankin, who was, of course, today's guest on Moments That Rock. Ian will be back in the future because, like you said, he's got plenty more stories to come. And it's wonderful when somebody like that, who's got a very successful career writing the crime novels that he does, that you talk to him about music and he just can't get away from the subject. Nice habit. We'll be back next week. If you enjoyed it, come back, subscribe, and maybe give us a review, eh? That'd be nice. See you next week. Bye-bye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.